Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed writers Ashley C. Ford and Eve L. Ewing discuss Ford's powerful memoir, Somebody's Daughter. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022 at the American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Sonal Shukla, and I am the Assistant Director of Programming and Education at the American Writers Museum. Welcome to the American Writers Festival and to this event. We're going to hear now from two multi-talented, extraordinarily versatile writers whose work across multiple genres has crossed boundaries and broken new ground. If you don't know who they are, well, it's because you don't have enough friends who are writers. This festival can help you with that. Ashley C. Ford's New York Times best-selling memoir, Somebody's Daughter, was published by Flatiron Books in June 2021. Ashley is the former host of the Chronicles of Now podcast, co-host of the HBO companion podcast, Lovecraft Country Radio. She currently lives in Indianapolis, Indiana, with her husband, poet and fiction writer Kelly Stacy, and their chocolate lab, Astro Renegade Ford Stacy. Ashley has written or guest edited for Elle Magazine, Slate, Teen Vogue, New York Magazine, The New York Times, Domino, Cup of Joe, and various other web and print publications. She's here today with Dr. Eve L. Ewing, a sociologist of education and a writer from Chicago. She's the award-winning author of four books, the poetry collections Electric Arches and 1919. The nonfiction work, Ghosts in the Schoolyard, Racism and School Crossings on Chicago's South Side, and most recently, a novel for young readers, Maya and the Robot. She's the co-author with Nate Marshall of the play No Blue Memories, The Life of Gwendolyn Brooks. She has written several projects for Marvel Comics, most notably the Ironheart series, as well as Marvel Team-Up and Champions. Eve is an assistant professor at the University of Chicago Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy and Practice. Her work has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and many other venues. Currently, she's working on her next book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism, which will be published by One World. Please put your hands together to welcome them on stage, Ashley and Eve.
Good afternoon. Hello. Welcome, Ashley. It's so good to have you here. How are you feeling?
It's so good to be here. They basically just said Eve Ewing in the request, and I said yes, because I wanted to come here and see you, and because I love Chicago. Oh. Every time I come here is a good time.
Well, I love you, and I love Chicago, so everybody here is having a good day so far. Let's see. So before, I mentioned to Ashley that before we started our conversation, I just wanted to be selfish and take a moment to say how grateful I am to be in the Cultural Center, especially for those who might be visiting from out of town, that this is an amazing building that is really important in my own personal history as a writer, partially because it's free to get in and has really good bathrooms. And so I spent a lot of time as a teenager kind of wandering aimlessly and so grateful to the American Writers Museum for having us here today. But our time is precious, so let's get into it. So Somebody's Daughter just came out on paperback. Congratulations. Everyone give it up for that.
Thank you.
And, you know, I think that when a book goes into the world, you kind of never really know what kind of life it's going to have, right? It goes out and has all these adventures without you. And so what has been joyous or unexpected about the life that this book has had?
I mean, every part of it has been joyous, and I've been really lucky with that. Usually when you write a book like this, when you're extremely vulnerable and honest about your family and the dynamics of your community, people get really mad. Mm-hmm. Or
people in your family.
Sometimes people get mad because they show up in the book and it's stuff like, I've heard this from other memoirs where it's like, I would never wear a shirt like what you described. And people get really upset, like, how could you lie about my shirt? I didn't have any of that, thank goodness. And I mean, my book came out, and a month later, we had a family reunion. So I was expecting for there to be some tough conversations, yeah. And there weren't any. I was very, very, very lucky in that. So it's been really unexpected how well received that it's been, and it's been really joyous how many people have reached out to say that some element of the book touched on an experience that they've had that they felt very lonely with, mm-hmm. very isolated with. And it occurred to them through reading that it could be that I am not the only one
right.
who's dealing with these issues. And I know what that was like for me as a reader right. every time I encountered those moments. So that feels really joyous and precious.
What were some of the books that did that for you that made you feel recognized and less lonely in that way?
Oh, man, there were so many. I read Romeo and Juliet in the third grade.
And, as one does.
And I remember the angst in that mm-hmm. story. The love story, of course, when you're a little girl or a little kid and you dream of one day knowing what that feels like because it seems like magic. There was that, but it was really the sorrow mm-hmm. of them, the sorrow of sort of wanting to be free and being or feeling trapped by circumstances that you didn't choose. I loved that mm-hmm. about that story. And I remember the first time I read The Cage Bird Sings. Mm-hmm, I remember mm-hmm. the first time I read The Bluest Eye. Mm-hmm. The first time I read The Bluest Eye, I was almost embarrassed, like felt like someone was telling on me or mm-hmm. telling mm-hmm. on people who I knew. And it was like, what if I get caught reading this book? Everybody's going to know that I know what she's talking about. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So those were some of the first ones.
Yeah, when you said that thing about feeling less lonely, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings was the first book that popped into my head because I know that book is that for so many people. Have you watched the Baz Luhrmann, Claire Danes, Leonardo DiCaprio, Romeo and Juliet?
Of course.
700 times, yeah.
Of course.
It's very good. It stands up. People should watch it.
I had my bridal party walk down the aisle to that Desiree song, Kissing You.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. It was very dramatic.
It's an iconic film. I taught eighth grade English, and I taught Romeo and Juliet like a good 15 years after that movie had come out, and seeing like 12 and 13 and 14-year-olds. Although my favorite line was one of my students is like, of course Mercutio is black. Like,
yeah.
They gotta make Mercutio the black dude. Which then I felt really proud. I'm like, oh, you really get Shakespeare.
Of course. I remember seeing that Mercutio was black and thinking like, yeah, he's the one who keeps it real.
Right.
The whole time. Exactly. He's the one who ends by being like, a curse on
all y'all's houses. Honestly, you and you. Yeah, a pox.
Yeah, a pox.
All y'all's houses. I say that to people sometimes in casual parlance. It's really, stick it to them. You know, I have a bunch of other questions, but I don't want to move on from what you mentioned about the family reunion, because I think for a lot of folks in the audience who are thinking about writing memoir, that aspect of memoir is very scary to a lot of people. And I heard some emphatic yeses from the audience. And so how did you prepare for that or think through, I know that you shared some versions of the book with different folks in your family. You just talk us through how you thought about that.
I tried really hard to own my story and to recognize a couple of things. One of them that I own everything that ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. If it happened to me, that's part of my story,
right?
And I'm allowed to tell it. I also had to get a lot of therapy and accept that my love for other people and their love for me did not require me to be silent about the ways that they had harmed me.
Mm. Everybody write that down.
And that was actually a really messed up kind of warped assumption that people have that on both sides, that if I love a person, I have to be silent about the way they harmed me. And also if they love me, if they really care about me, they will be silent about the ways I hurt them. I had to accept that members of my family, and I mean even like specifically my mom, that I could believe that I loved her and she loved me, but that telling the truth about my life was not a betrayal. She might take it that way. She might react as if it is that way, but what do I believe? Do I believe it's a betrayal? And the answer was no. And at some point, I had to be strong enough to stand in my own belief because I'm doing a lot of reparenting of myself. And I know, you know, from reading, from hearing it from different people, you know, this author I love, I don't know why I'm blanking right now because she's actually my friend in real life and I hope she forgives me. But
no one tell. Nobody even a snitch.
She has this line in her book where she says the minute she started being a good mother was when she stopped being an obedient daughter. And I realized that that was something that I needed for myself. In order to mother myself the way that I needed, I had to stop being an obedient daughter. Not a good daughter, but an obedient one. And that really helped me.
Wow. You know, that insight about decoupling silence from love, I think, is something that a lot of us could use. And I think that different writers have different experiences with hurt, right? So there, we hear folks say very often that they write to work through hurts. They write to work out feelings. I'm quite on the other side of the spectrum. I will not write about something until I've done my own private thing. Where do you, how do you feel about the relationship between writing and, you know, are you writing through your hurts? You mentioned that you had a lot of therapy before getting here.
It's both. I think that I thought I was incredibly prepared to write the book. I knew how long I'd been in therapy. I knew all the things I talked about and tried to process. So yeah, of course I'm ready to write this book. How long can you talk about these things before you're ready to write them down? And my book showed me the hubris of that belief, like, very quickly. And it wasn't that the actual writing of it felt like therapy or that it was cathartic in any way. It was more so that the writing of it pointed out the places where I was not done doing my personal work. In writing the book, I decided to go back and sort of meet myself in the back timeline, in the past, and I had to go to all these different versions of myself and meet them. And sometimes they told me things that I'd forgotten, that I'd wanted to forget, that I chose to forget, in some cases that I forgot because I just didn't want to remember. And when I confronted those versions of me and had those conversations, quite often things would bubble up to the surface that it's like you are not going to be ready to move into the next phase of writing this story, of creating this work until you deal with you. Because the version of you that needs to write that part doesn't exist yet and you have to go find her.
Oh my gosh, Ashley, that takes so much courage because when you write books, there's also like people asking you questions about when the book is going to be done, right? And so, you know, one of the things I loved about the book was seeing you re-enter into a kind of tender relationship with a young version of yourself and caring her, showing care to her that perhaps she was not shown through the events that are, that you're writing about. So I wonder where you are now in your relationship to her and how, you know, if there's anything you want to tell her, the various Ashleys that we meet in this book.
At this point, I feel like me and my child self have a really very good relationship, but me and my teen self are about to tussle. That's how I feel. I feel like my child self, I'm really good at talking with her. I'm really good at addressing her fears and her desires. I'm really good at having patience and compassion with her. And I feel like my angry, I know everything teen self is completely different. And parts of that are coming out, and there's just a lot of anger. There's so much anger because that's really the age where I started to realize that a lot of what I had been told about the trajectory of my life or the potential of my life was going to be tempered by things that were out of my control.
Yeah.
The teen years is when the guidance counselors start to get real with you and say, you're not going to be able to afford that school. I don't care if it is your dream, and I don't care what your grades are. The teen years are when you start to notice that, like, things really cost money. Like, oh, I'm not going to be able to go to prom unless I can borrow somebody's dress.
Right.
I'm not going to get senior pictures taken because we can't afford those. I may have lettered, but I'm not going to get the letterman jacket because I can't afford it. And you start seeing that the world that you've been raised to believe that you exist in and the potential that adults always told you, like, you just need to leap over
and
this.
And do your part.
You've been doing your part.
Yeah.
And the world not only has no interest in meeting you there, but will kind of mock you for thinking that they would and will kind of tell you to just grow up. And you're 15 years old being like, I can't take this cool internship or opportunity because I don't have enough money.
Right.
I'm 15.
Right.
And I think that there is part of me that is still so angry around those circumstances, around feeling unprotected, unsupported, feeling like the patience for my youth was run out by the time I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we're not having a great time, me and the inner teen, but the rest of us are partying.
The 20-year-old version of yourself is waiting around the corner.
We're waiting around the corner. Watching,
right, you know, I think of Sandra Cisneros has the one of my favorite short stories, 11, in which she says, mm-hmm. you know, when you're 11, you're also 10 and 9 and 8, and nobody tells you that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this in preparation for our conversation, and I think that I first saw you read an essay from what would evolve into this work in 2015. Right? What an innocent time, a simpler time in America. And I wonder how the work has evolved. You know, part of being an essayist is that you're working things out. Right. And so how is the collection that we see, you know, what tell us about the journey you've been on, not the collection, how's the final volume that we see, you know, reflective of that journey that you've been on for all these years?
I think that if anybody who heard me talk about the book I was writing in 2015 or even people who read the jacket copy will be like, oh, you know, this book is going to be a lot about her relationship with her dad, who's incarcerated. But it's about his absence.
Mm.
It's not about, I try to tell people sometimes when, you know, I've heard that even as a critique, and I've just kind of been like, well, honey, if he was in prison, like,
he wasn't
there.
Right,
like,
right,
by definition, he wasn't there. Like,
right.
That's kind of the point. And one of the things I realized when I was writing the book was that I was trying really hard not to write me. I was trying really hard to write about my experience of other people, kind of, but it was about them. I wanted it to be about what was going on around me, and I didn't actually want my voice to really be part of it. And that was not working for a myriad of reasons. One, it's a memoir. The first two words are literally, like, the first word in memoir is me.
Yeah, and then,
like,
it's moi.
You know, and then it's more. So it's like I had to write about me. But also what I was realizing is that it was because I was still not owning my story.
Right,
like,
right.
It took me so long to recognize that just because my perception and my view of what was going on when I was 10 or 11 wasn't respected doesn't mean that it wasn't mine.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that it wasn't accurate from my perception. And it didn't mean that I couldn't hold on to it as I didn't need anybody else's permission. I didn't need anybody else's version of it. I could trust myself. And that's really the through line, I think, of the process of writing the book from beginning to end, was that if this book taught me anything, it was that I can trust myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm allowed. So yeah, that's pretty much like how that process went. It was like, how much can I trust me? How much do I trust me? And how much am I willing to share?
That's so deep and so meta, right? Because so much of the book is about you experiencing that sense of your vision of the world, your experience of the world is not being trustworthy or reliable. Other people trying to convince you that your version of events and your vision of the world is not reliable. So I think it's really beautiful and profound that you came out on the other side of that in real present time. I think that's really amazing. Has that changed the way you view children, the way you view conflict? I'm just thinking about that lesson of, you know, 10-year-old Ashley's version of events is sufficient. How does that change the way you move through the world and other, you know, situations?
I have such a respect for parents, right? I'm not a parent. I have a huge respect for the job. But my respect for children has probably gone up threefold, and I was already on kids' side. Okay, like, I don't have kids. I used to be a nanny. Like, me and kids, we hang out. Like, when the parents are around, it's like, cool, we're doing other stuff. So it went up even more, because one of the things that I had to really look at as I was writing this book, and I had to understand in my child self as I was writing the book, was the feeling of helplessness. Helplessness. You are a child. You're small. You're still learning about the world around you. You don't have no money. There are broke best friends. They ain't got no money. And the adults around you, and most likely your parents or guardians, are the people you love and trust most in the entire world. And sometimes, more often than we want to admit, that trust is betrayed over and over and over. A lot of adults, not all of them, but I just think about my childhood, a lot of adults treat kids like somebody's gonna press a button when we turn 18 and hit reset, and we're just gonna forget about all the shitty things they did and said to us. Like, at some point, we're just gonna be like, oh, well, I'm an adult now, so it doesn't count what happened to me when I was 10. But it's like you said, an 11-year-old is still 10. And 9, and 8, and 7, all of that is still inside her. All of that is still inside you. You may think you got away from it, but trust me, probably the people in your life know the ways that you haven't gotten away from your child self and from the triggers of your child self. That's everybody. So the most beautiful, amazing thing I feel like we could do for kids is to give them the best start possible. Every child, the best start possible. And the only reason we don't do that is because of the lack of respect for childhood. The fact that a lot of people still do think they're gonna get to press that button. The fact that a lot of people try to punish adults through their children. The people who come up to me and say stuff like, you know, when I read your book, it made me so sad. I cried. Like, I thought about, you know, why wouldn't she be able to just visit her dad? Why couldn't they make it easier? Why couldn't they make it so that she could call? Why are calls so expensive? And the thing that I feel sometimes in that moment, I try not to, but I do, is why didn't you care before? Why didn't you care before this moment that there are and always have been, as long as we have had mass incarceration issues in this country, which is always, as long as that has been true, there have been children separated from their parents in such a way that they are unable to maintain any kind of a healthy relationship with them. My relationship with my dad turned out okay, you know, so far, but that is through no help from the state. That's just my dad doggedly writing letters for 30 years trying to connect with me. Trying. Every kid deserves better than that. So how I feel about children now is even more ferocious than when I started writing the book, because I am even more convinced of what children deserve, and I am even more angry at any adult who would try to keep them from it. Enough to fight physically, but that's because of where I'm from.
No, I really appreciate you saying that, and I think that the impulse toward punishment, right, the impulse toward control and surveillance, and the assumption that, as you said, that that extends from the adult to their children, who, and also the assumption that some kids don't get to be kids, right, don't deserve childhood, don't deserve the protected status of childhood or the presumptive innocence of childhood, I think is a really powerful force in our culture that permeates so much of what we do even before you get to the actual walls of the prison. So I'm really grateful for your advocacy and just you sharing, just sharing what you shared. So thank you.
Thank you.
A couple, you know, other areas in which your creative work has really blossomed in the last several years are podcasts and profiles. And some of you've done so many amazing profiles. We were just chatting before we came up about how your first ever profile was Janelle Monáe. In the last couple years, you've profiled Alicia Keys, Stacey Abrams, Billy Porter. Could you talk a little bit about each of these two media, podcasts and profiles, and what you like about them? What do they do for you?
Well, profiles I like because it's not writing about me. It's the exact opposite. So whenever I'm writing a profile, I get to dig deep into somebody else's life and their story and their career. And then I get to go have some conversation or some experience with them and write about my perspective of who they are as an artist, and also some of their perspectives on their art, on others' art, on the importance of art, of the world, like whatever is relevant to the piece, whatever feels most interesting to me. That's a lot of fun. That is a big fun way to write nonfiction for me, because I am not involved at all and do not have to have my therapist on speed dial at that moment. And then with podcasts, I think it's pretty clear that I like to talk.
And you're great. You also have a great soothing voice.
Thank you.
Like you have a great voice and a great smile. And so when I'm listening to something and you're a guest or you're hosting, I'm like, oh, Ashley's here. Like, this is so reassuring.
Thank you. I think I sound a lot like Whoopi Goldberg.
That's great. Yes. Own it.
I get that a lot, especially when I used to do stand-up and I would be in like my comedy mode, which I don't think my voice sounds that different when I am, but it's just the cadence. I would always get off stage and somebody would be like, you sound like Whoopi Goldberg. And I'd be like, right, but I
hear
have
it
eyebrows.
Now. I hear it now. I hear the gravelly undertone.
It's weird, but it's awesome. Works for me.
It's excellent.
And then I get to do podcasts, which end up being so fun. Every time I do a podcast, I get to learn a lot and then talk a lot about something that I probably would never have maintained that rabbit hole long enough to get there, mm-hmm. because of just the way my attention span works. So right now I'm making a podcast with Ben and Jerry's, mm-hmm. right? Which is so fun.
Delightful.
Which is delightful, especially whenever you can work free ice cream.
I was about
contract,
to say, do you get free ice cream?
Yes, I do get
excellent.
Free
do
ice cream.
Do they mail it to you? Yes, clap. Don't tell your kids that it's not a lucrative enterprise to be a writer,
it's
okay?
It's a lucrative because enterprise.
You too can one day get Ben
your child could be swimming in fish food. Yeah, I get to interview all these fun people doing. I got to interview John Legend. I got to interview Big Frida. I got to interview Andrew Aiden, who worked really closely with Congressman Lewis for years, which was so much fun. I got to do all of these amazing things, and it's just talking. And I could talk all day until I'm done. And then I'm really, really done. And then I need to, like, shut myself in a room.
What is your favorite Ben & Jerry's flavor?
My favorite Ben & Jerry's flavor is half-baked.
Oh, that's a good one.
With the cookie dough and the
brownie. Yeah, that's a solid choice.
Yeah.
That's a solid choice. Mine is, I'm a little embarrassed that my favorite Ben & Jerry's is like one of these like licensed, you know, collabo deals.
Which one is it?
It's Stephen Colbert's American Dream.
It's so good.
It's so good. It has waffle cones in it. For any Chicagoans in the audience, which I presume is almost virtually all of you, I used to work at Margie's Candies, so I used to work at an ice cream parlor. So I'm very passionate about ice cream. Have you ever, sorry, one last Ben & Jerry's question. Have you ever been to the Ben & Jerry's factory in Vermont?
No, they want me to come.
You should go.
Record. Oh, I will.
You should go. One time I drove home, I drove from Montreal south, and I was like, let's go through Vermont. And the only thing I knew about Vermont was that they had Ben and Jerry's. And so I was like, I was on Google Maps, like, but the only thing was there were all these signs like moose crossing. And I was so afraid for my life of hitting a moose. And so I drove through Vermont like this, like in deep, abject fear, but also like, I gotta get to Ben and Jerry. So you should have them fly you. Don't do that. Don't do what I did. Okay, I want to ask you a couple more questions before we go to the audience. I have a couple life things I want to ask you about. Mm-hmm. One is you moved back home to Indiana after being everyone's consummate fave, you know, Brooklyn writer for many years. What does it mean for you to be home?
It means I get to participate. I don't just have to watch my friends and their kids live their lives and be like, you know, like, that's cute. I'm glad that happened. I get to go. I get to be there. I get to be Aunt Ashley in the crowd and in the stands. I get to be Aunt Ashley. One of my friend's kids, one of my best friends, her daughter is a horse girl.
Wow.
And she just started, like, in the last year. And she had a competition this weekend that I couldn't go to because I was here. Thanks, guys. No, just kidding. I love being here. But she's won, like, she's like a new writer, but she's just really good. And she did 8 events and won like 5 gold ribbons.
Amazing.
Or blue ribbons.
Even better,
gold stars,
probably.
Blue ribbons. Oh, blue ribbon.
Yeah, the best one.
And I was just like, oh my God, like so excited because I get to go meet her horse.
Yeah.
I get to go.
What's
do
the
those
horse's
things.
Name?
I don't know.
Oh.
I think it's called like Licorice or something like that.
I thought it was going to have like a Ben and Jerry's name.
I know? Wish.
Like have like I know horses have long names.
It's Licorice or something. But yeah, I get to be the person who when my mom friends are overwhelmed and they're juggling 15 million things that they can be like, "Ashley, can you pick Gloria up from school?" It's you know, it's just and I'm like, "Yeah. That's yeah, so I can great. Do it right now. I can go." And that's one of the ways when I talk about wanting the world to be different for children, I know that I don't have children, but I know that I'm part of that whether or not
right.
I have children.
Right.
And I know that one of the best things I can do for the children in my life and in my community is be a really, really good friend to their moms.
Yes. Yeah.
And yeah, so that's why I moved back. I moved back to participate in the lives of the people I love.
That's so exciting, and I think such an amazingly different vision of what success looks like. Like, it's just like a vision of a joyful life that is so different than I think what is offered to, you know, writers in their early 20s, and I'm just excited for you for modeling that. Okay, another life thing I have to ask about is Astro, who is your dog, for those not in the know. I have no follow-up or prompt. I simply would like you to talk about Astro for as long as you see fit.
Well, now we're holding you hostage. My dog, Astro, is the best in the whole world. He's a chocolate lab, and he right now is with his grandparents. At their house. They call him their grand pup. He's phenomenal. He just got a fantastic report card from the vet.
Oh, very nice.
He's been doing really great. He's taking his treats that help his joints because he's getting a little older, but we don't talk about that. The vet called him middle-aged. Almost jumped across the table on her. I said, he's a puppy. He's going to live forever.
Yeah.
Everybody accepts that except you. And yeah, he's an amazing dog. I knew that I would love a dog. I knew that I would like having a dog. I had no idea that you could feel this strongly about an animal. Mm-hmm. And I'm just obsessed, and I would be embarrassed if it wasn't true.
No, it's so, I just think that dogs teach us so much. I also feel like as the dog writers, we have to stand up against the cat writers. Because they think that they're like, you know, there was an essay several years ago about how, like, no good writers have dogs.
Yes!
Which people should Google if you don't think this is real. It was a real essay. It was in the New Yorker. And, you know, I just think the cat writers, they think that they're, like, the cerebral and the, you know, the serious writers.
What do they know about
What do they
love?
Know? Right.
What do they know about
Some
real
of y'all are
love?
In abusive relationships with your cats.
I know.
You're like, my cat punched me in the eye this morning. I'm like, that's not.
No, you're like, oh, no. my cat knocked a knocked water off of the bed frame and almost drowned me in my sleep. It's so cute. And it's like, what?
That's terrible. Yeah, it's really
bad. I think
she
tried to take you out.
Yeah, your cat has designs, bad designs on your life.
Right.
I'm also deeply allergic to cats. So I'm a little biased.
So they're definitely trying to take you out.
Yeah, they're literally trying to take me out. I have one last question. So you have done so many interviews, mm-hmm. and I wonder, what is the question that you always wish someone would ask you in an interview?
The question I always wish someone would ask me?
Or the thing you'd secretly like to discuss?
Nobody ever asked me about boy bands, which I know a lot about, and really wish that I could share my knowledge on that sometimes. And nobody, you know, I don't get asked a lot of questions about horror.
Mm-hmm.
Which sometimes I'm like, come on, guys! Like, I
even
love
though you
horror.
Were on Lovecraft is kind of like a. I mean, in my view, mostly
I
horror.
I love horror. I love horror, and I love movies in general. But I love horror, and I've done a lot of interviews in different spaces, writing in different spaces, podcasting about horror. But people don't want to think of me as like the horror person. They're like, you're the one that makes us cry.
Yeah.
About our feelings.
Not to be like extra predictably myself about this, but do you think that has to do with race and gender?
Oh, yeah. It's part of it. It's definitely part
of it. Like who gets to be a horror expert?
Yeah. But then I think about like Tanana Reeve Du,
mm-hmm.
who is amazing. Yeah. And I look up to her so much. And I'm always thinking about what she's been able to do. I think about Nia DaCosta,
yes.
who did, you know, the last version of Candyman.
Yes.
And
a Chicago classic.
You know, I'm always, you know, trying to pay attention to Black women in the horror space because, yeah, we don't ever really get to talk about it. But and it's so much fun to talk about. Who doesn't want to talk about Tales in the Hood?
Right. Oh, me, because it's too scary. please invite Ashley onto your horror podcast. I have a totally unrelated follow-up.
What's that?
Could you talk to us about boy bands for a moment? Tell us.
Oh, yeah, I can tell you.
I spontaneously had this
I mean, we
could
talk about anything. Mostly 90s boy bands. I can tell you that I will never choose between Backstreet Boys.
And NSYNC. That was what I was going to ask you to choose, though.
It's a value.
Okay.
At this point, I will not choose between the two.
Wait, do you have
a
fave member of the, if we were to put them in a collective?
Oh, yeah, I have a fave member. Yeah, well, in NSYNC, my fave member would probably be JC.
Okay.
Okay, and then in Backstreet Boys, my favorite member is AJ, which was not true when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I was like, he's doing too much. Like the sunglasses and the piercings and stuff like that. But now he's
grown.
On TikTok as an adult and he's great.
Yeah.
He's the best one. When I was a kid, it was definitely Nick Carter. But that's because
thought you were going to say Nick Carter.
It's the Jonathan Taylor Thomas
thing. He's the JTT.
You know, they had us in a chokehold
at
that age.
They did. I'm embarrassed to talk about how much I liked Jonathan Taylor Thomas as a kid.
I feel
safe here. If you were to choose any three members, no, let's do two. If you were to choose any two members from the collective of NSYNC, the Backstreet Boys, and 98 Degrees to branch off and start their own a spin-off duo that has a slightly antagonistic relationship to the original groups, like they are beefing a little bit, who are your two that are going to split off?
We're going to take 98 Degrees off the table.
Okay.
And the only reason we're going to do that is because I read Jessica Simpson's memoir, Open Book, and Nick Lachey...
He's not a good... Not
his
a good
days guy. Are numbered. He better...
He better...
He better not ever catch me on the street, because we will have him and John Mayer. We going to fist
fight. Oh, John Mayer is... That's a rap.
But of NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, I think that... I think that the two that would be antagonistic that would be the most fun is if like a Joey Fatone
yes.
and a Chris Kirkpatrick
yes.
got together and we're just like, yeah, no, we're doing our own
thing.
And like, F you guys, you never treated us right.
What would their group be called?
I don't know. It would be like, I don't know. Let's call it Street Sync.
Oh, that's good. I was thinking Joe Chris.
Yeah.
Yours is better. Yours is better. I have a final question, which is if you had to get, like, Ashley, there's a meteor hurtling towards Earth, and the only way that we can stop this meteor is we created this machine, and it's powered by you getting a tattoo of a boy band lyric. Yeah. Otherwise, millions of people will die. What's the lyric? And you have 45 seconds to make this.
It would be Get Another Boyfriend from the Black and Blue Backstreet Boys album.
Amazing. Wow. Thank you for coming.
I don't know why I knew that, but we did it.
I'm so grateful that everyone came to our session, Boy Band History, with Eve and Ashley. Catch us next week where we'll be discussing the disrespect that was levied against New Edition. And we will have a special guest.
Bobby Brown.
Bobby Brown.
It will be Bobby Brown.
Yes. Yes, please join us. Please join us at the front if you'd like to ask Ashley a question.
Hello, ladies. So awesome to listen to you talk to each other. It's the best ever. My name is Atina Danner. Cat rider, also dog rider, both. My question is, so I had to write it down. So artists and writers understand ourselves, like the huge importance of seeing ourselves represented, in whatever our crafts are. But for the people who don't know that need, who don't like feel it in their gut to need to see themselves to, you know, further their capacity for creation in the world. What is your advice for those people who are, you know, the resource distributors and the programming setters who are not necessarily creatives themselves and don't necessarily feel that pull to have representation in that way? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, for folks who couldn't hear in the back, I think the question was essentially, if people don't get why representation matters and the gatekeepers and people in power are not making decisions that reflect that, how do you make them understand? Is that?
Well, my question is, what is your advice to those people as a creative yourself?
Like, what would I ask the gatekeepers?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Give it to the gatekeepers, please.
Listen, the thing that I would say to people most of all is that when I talked earlier about trusting yourself, why that's so important is because it allows you to trust other people. Because you don't actually need them to do anything any kind of way because you know what you're gonna do, no matter what. And I think that a lot of what happens in gatekeeping is people doing a kind of means testing and saying, you know, like, oh, well, let me make sure the people who get it actually need it, you know, stuff like that. When the truth of the matter is, you really just need to give people things. And I know that that sounds wrong because we live in America, but it's okay. It's okay to just give people things. It's okay that somebody says, I need more time to write. And maybe you don't have a place they can go. Maybe you don't have a plane ticket for them. Maybe all you have is money. And you think to yourself, well, you can't just give people money. Give people money. Give people money. Do you know what has helped me become the artist I am? My publisher gave me a lot of money. A lot of money to write my book. And all the times when I was writing this book where I felt like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have like a breakdown. I'm going to freak out, or I need like 3 days of doing nothing. I was able to do that for myself because I wasn't worried about how I was going to eat if I did. And you can do a lot with your art emotionally. You can do a lot creativity. You can create a lot of creative work if you're not trying to survive the day. Everybody's got to do some work to survive, okay? I get that. But when you're trying to just survive the day, every day, where do you find room to write things down, to think critically about how the story is moving, if it's doing what you want it to do, if you're doing what the story wants you to do? When do you have the time to stop and be quiet and actually think about it if you're in struggle survival mode constantly? Can some people do it? Sure, I guess. Should they have to? No. No. And we shouldn't think that just because some people can do it, that everybody should have to create under those circumstances. That's not giving us the best possible creations that we could be getting from art makers in this place. So just give people what they need. Give it to them directly. Let them trust them enough to know that they know what they need in order to make what they want to see in the world. But trusting other people requires trusting yourself. Mm-hmm. So maybe work on both at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, love that. We have time for another question if folks would like to
Anyone
step
else?
Up. Yeah.
Thank you for what you put out into the world, both of you, actually. And I have a question about the spectacular success of the book. Did you have a hard time assimilating that? And when you were done, it's not over. It's having a life of its own. But as you were assimilating that, did you experience emotions that you were prepared for? And have you been able to rest since then? And how are you resisting the capitalist call to do it again and do it more and do it faster and keep it going? I would love to hear you talk about that.
Well, first of all, I'm learning that my expectations are always a little lower than they should be when they come to me. I think part of my brain thinks that if I temper my excitement, it will then temper my disappointment.
There it is. Me too.
But that doesn't work. We think it works. It's child logic. It doesn't work. You'll still be disappointed. You just won't have the benefit of having been excited when you could be excited, which, as it turns out, teaches you to only think about how poorly things can go. And then when things go well, you don't know what to do, and you kind of freak out over that because you don't have a plan for things going well. And that was me in some cases. But I'm really lucky that I had people around me, people who I was in contact with and direct connection with, who were either going through the same thing at the same time or had been through it years before. And they were able to talk to me about the feelings that would come up. I was still in like an excited place, but also very like, oh my gosh, what is happening? And I had friends reach out and were like, I'm so happy for you. I'm so glad this is happening. You're gonna get really depressed in like 4 months. And it's okay. I want you to know right now that you're gonna think to yourself, why am I depressed? Everything went so well. This went better than I could ever imagine. Why am I feeling this way? You're feeling this way because you were just up here for months. And it's okay to feel that, but eventually you're gonna come down. It's gonna feel like a big drop, and there's gonna be some recovery. And so I knew that that was going to happen, or I prepared for that to happen. And I spent a long time being like, you know what? Maybe I got out of it because I feel fine. You know, maybe that was them who got depressed. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks, like just a few months ago. And I was like, oh no. But I was able to call people and reach out and have the conversations and know that I was okay. Just knowing that I was okay, even in the midst of feeling all that, helped me to just let it happen, process it, and try to like pick up on ways to take really good care of myself during this time, which mostly means drinking a lot of water. Nobody's drinking enough water. So I did a lot of that, and it helped. Feeding myself things that tasted good and felt good to my body. Great advice. Really, moving more, walking, it helps, you know, but I didn't push myself. And when you talk about that capitalistic like thing where it's like, hey, the book came out, it's doing well. What's next? What's next? What's next? How are you capitalizing off this moment? That's another part of the reason why I moved back to Indiana. I knew that I would need some distance from a certain kind of energy and a certain kind of expectation after my book came out. And it's really, if you just don't look at your email and don't read your text until a certain time of the day, you're not going to run into anybody in Indiana. You're not going to, like, or at least where I am, you're not going to like have to have a weird conversation with somebody about what you're up to. It's easier to keep the work in the workplace and to only address it when it's time and when I've put in the time to address it. That really works for me. And I also I see my friends and the people around me who took the moment, who seized it, and just started going full steam ahead. And so many of them burnt out so quick, or are even burnt out right now while they're doing things. They're having their dream moment, getting to work on a dream project, and they're miserable while they're doing it because of how burnt out they are. I don't want to do that. I've been really lucky to be in a place in my life right now where all the work I do is work I want to do. And if I'm going to do work I want to do, if I'm going to be lucky enough to have a life like that, then I also want to be able to show up to those opportunities fully myself, fully ready to do it, fully ready to jump in with all my excitement intact and well rested. And that has meant taking a lot of breaks. Sometimes I email my assistant because I've been looking at my calendar and I see I've got everything every weekend for whatever. And I go, okay, we're done adding stuff this month. And I'm looking 2 months out. There's a 2-week gap there where I don't have anything going on. We're not going to put anything in there. And I'm going to take that 2 weeks. I'm just going to be at home. I'm probably working anyway, but it's when I want to work and what I want to work on. And that makes everything that I've created under those circumstances so much more beautiful and meaningful to me. And I get to have these experiences now that I haven't always had, where like, now I know how to be proud of myself. That sounds really weird. Like, everybody knows how to be proud of themselves. No, everybody doesn't. And I definitely didn't. I didn't know that I was allowed to sit back in the middle of my accomplishment and say, I'm proud of this. I'm so happy this exists, and I'm so happy that I got to be involved. And when you get an experience like that, it's addictive. You want a lot of it. You want most of your experiences to be like that. So, yeah, I rest because I want that over and over again, hopefully for the rest of my life.
Ashley, I'm so deeply grateful for the person you are, for the writer you are, and for the ways that you've shared and modeled for us today, how to treat ourselves with love and kindness and how to carry that forth and how we interact with others. I'm grateful to call you a friend. I'm grateful to know you and to be on this planet at the same time as you. And I hope everyone will join me in a big round of applause and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Eve.
Please, for Eve.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Will Jawando discusses his book, Seven Black Fathers, a young activist's memoir of race, family, and the mentors who made him whole, with Carolyn Curiel, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.